Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Dr. Jessica Pierce. Jessica is a bioethicist, philosopher, and author. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
The Center for Biological Diversity reports that UNESCO World Heritage Committee gave Mexico 1 year to improve protections for the only remaining home of the critically endangered vaquita, or invasive danger designation for the Gulf of California site. The committee vowed to closely monitor Mexico's effort to protect the islands and the protected areas of the Gulf of California World Heritage Site and the nearly extinct vaquita, a tiny porpoise that can only be found there. The site was created in part to protect critically endangered vaquita and a fish called the totobaba. In 2015, the Animal Welfare Institute and the Center for Biological Diversity petitioned the World Heritage Committee to list the site as endangered due to the species decline. An attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity emphasizes that vaquitas are on the precipice of vanishing from the earth forever, and the World Heritage Committee's decision adds yet another urgent call to the chorus, demanding that Mexico drastically step up enforcement and save the vaquita before it's too late. One of the main reasons fewer than 30 of the tiny vaquita porpoises remain is because they continue to become entangled in gill nets illegally set to capture a species of fish, the totoaba. The totoaba swim bladders are in high demand in China and other Asian countries where they're believed to have healing powers. Illegal fishing is rampant in the region. Since February 2016, wildlife protection organizations, the Mexican government, and fishermen have collected 374 illegal nets, including 220 active fish nets and 41 abandoned nets. And that was only in 139 days of searching. Historically, the shrimp industry in the Gulf was responsible for killing hundreds of vaquitas that became entangled in gill nets used to catch shrimp. The committee was scheduled to take a final vote on the site's status at the 41st World Heritage Meeting going on in Krakow, Poland, but the committee chose to delay its decision, acknowledging Mexico's June 30 proclamation of a rule permanently banning gill net use in a large proportion of the Upper Gulf of California. The rule, while a step forward, has been criticized for not banning the sale or manufacture of gillnets in the region, and for exempting two fisheries from the gillnet ban, and for failing to address significant weaknesses in law enforcement. As part of the ongoing effort to urge the Mexican government to rigorously enforce laws to protect the rapidly vanishing species, a rally was held on June 6th outside the Mexican embassy in Washington, D.C. This was held in conjunction with the International Save the Vaquita Day that was on July 8th. This is one of several events happening across the country and the world this week to help highlight the needs of the vaquita. To find out how to show support for the vaquita, please visit boycottmexicanshrimp.com.
In 2011, the factory farming industry started pushing for so-called ag gag laws, which prevent animal advocates from taking pictures or video at animal farming operations. Ag gag laws were designed to prevent animal protection groups from exposing animal abuse and other crimes at their facilities in dozens of states. Most of those bills were defeated, but a handful of states passed them into law. On Friday, July 7, a federal judge struck down Utah's ag gag law, siding with animal rights advocates that the statute, which prohibits unauthorized filming of agricultural operations, violates free speech rights. U.S. District Judge Robert Shelby made the ruling on a case in which two animal rights groups and an activist sued the state over the Agriculture Operation Interference Law, approved in 2012 by the Utah legislature. The law prohibited lying to gain access to a livestock operation, made secret recording illegal, and required permission from the owner for someone who wishes to film. Ag gag laws criminalize undercover operations by activists or journalists. Stephen Wells, executive director of the Animal Legal Defense Fund, one of the plaintiffs in the case, said in a statement, Ag gag laws are flagrant attempts to hide animal cruelty from the American people, and they unfairly target activists trying to serve the public interest. In his ruling, Judge Shelby wrote that Utah undoubtedly has an interest in addressing perceived threats to the state agricultural industry, and it has a variety of constitutionally permissible tools at its disposal to do so. Suppressing broad swaths of protected speech without justification, however, is not one of them. State attorneys had argued that the ag gag law protects the safety of animals and workers. Judge Shelby rejected that argument and said that when lawmakers passed the law in 2012, they didn't express safety concerns, but instead said the law targeted a group of people that want to put us out of business and vegetarian people that are trying to kill the animal industry. The lawsuit was brought by two organizations, the Animal Legal Defense Fund and People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, along with Amy Meyer, who in 2013 became the first person charged in Utah with violating the ag gag law. Meyer had been on public property when she used her cell phone to record a meatpacking plant, but prosecutors still charged her with the Class B misdemeanor. The charge was dropped shortly after it was filed. Meyer said in a statement Friday that she filmed a sick cow that was being pushed with a front-end loader. "I was shocked when I was the one charged with a crime instead of the animal abusers," Meyer said. This is the second ag gag law to be found unconstitutional by a federal court. With the laws in Idaho and now Utah overturned, only ag gag laws in Iowa, Missouri, Arkansas, and North Carolina remain on the books.
From One Green Planet, bears have long fascinated humans with their impressive fishing and foraging skills, their hibernation practices, and their adorable cuddly cubs. Theodore Roosevelt was so enamored with bears as a symbol of the freedom of the West that he created the teddy bear, a stuffed toy that has become the favorite of children around the world. However, despite people's apparent fondness for these impressive animals, bears are exploited by humans for a profit in circuses, tourist attractions, and the bile industry. Across the world, bears are kept in cramped cages for up to 30 years and forced to endure painful bile extractions from their gallbladder, which is then used in cosmetics, medicines, and even wine. Several organizations have been fighting to save these beautiful bears, and many have been successful. However, according to a petition on Care2, there are still too many bears suffering on bile farms across the world, including an estimated 1,300 bears in Vietnam alone. Although the petition acknowledges that the Vietnamese government has made progress towards ending bile farms, there is still a lot that needs to be done. The petition is calling on us to sign a letter addressed to the Vietnamese government asking for major changes to ensure bears are no longer farmed for bile extraction, that bear farms are strictly monitored with penalties and confiscations for those who do not comply with the law, and ultimately to shut down all bile farms by 2020 and send all of the bears to rescue centers and sanctuaries. The power to save these beautiful bears begins with you. You can sign the petition at onegreenplanet.org. Stay with us. Coming up next is a conversation with Dr. Jessica Pierce, bioethicist and author of several books, including The Last Walk, Reflections on Our Pets at the End of Their Lives, The Animal's Agenda, Freedom, Compassion, and Coexistence in the Human Age, and Hospice and Palliative Care for Companion Animals, Principles and Practices. That's next on Animal Concerns of Texas. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Jessica Pierce. Thanks for being with us, Jessica.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Jessica, can we start out by having you tell our listeners how you got involved in animal issues?
Sure. I think the answer that I give is probably similar to a lot of people. I think I always have been. I grew up with animals in the home. We had three dogs. I'm actually named after one of our dogs, Jesse, which I'm very proud of. Except she was a little crazy, so
aren't we all?
I guess that explains things.
That's right.
I just always had a love of animals, and I really started off my career in bioethics, in the human side of things, and part of the reason I didn't focus on animals is because during my training, my PhD program, and working at a medical school, it seemed like the only outlet was animal research, and I tried being involved in that realm, and it just, I found it so distressing personally that I couldn't do it. So I kind of backed off and had a human bioethics for a while, and then getting back into it, really, I have to say it was thanks to my dog, Odie. He passed away about 8 years ago, and when he was in his final year or two of life, and really when it was becoming clear that his life was going to end before long and his quality of life was really compromised, I realized how similar the things were that I was dealing with Odie, as sort of the things that I was dealing with in my professional work as a bioethicist, because it's really all about, so much of what we do in bioethics is death and dying, end of life issues. That's where some of the most complex moral dilemmas come up. And it's the same thing with our animals. And that really got me, I guess, convinced that I could make a career out of writing about animals, or that I didn't care so much about my career and I'd rather just write about what I'm passionate about.
Wow.
You know, and if my career follows, that's fine. And if not, I'm doing what I love.
Uh-huh.
So, and luckily, you know, the career part of it has worked out. And so I'm so happy that I now just write about what I love.
Well, you know, you detail your experience with Odie in your book, The Last Walk, Reflections on Our Pets and the End of Life. Did you, when you were going through this process with Odie, did you find that there were many good resources, or you know, how did you try to find a way to cope with all the myriad of difficult feelings that go with you know, an animal, your companion animal, who's on the decline in their health?
Yeah, you know, I think why I wrote it and what I wrote about was my frustration with myself and all the things that I felt that I was doing wrong and couldn't find resources for. And as a result of writing the book, and sort of why I wrote the book, is to provide those resources for people going through this so they don't have to recreate the wheel each time. But just to give an example, you know, I wasn't really aware at the time that Odie was beginning to suffer that there were vets who specialized in pain management. Had I known that, I would have probably sought one out, and that would have been really good for Odie. And I didn't, you know, there just were a lot of things like, and there were a lot of resources available, but you don't even really know what questions to ask when you have an elderly dog and it's the first time you've gone through it. So, for example, I really just was clueless about things like physical modifications to my home, you know, putting down yoga mats or rugs so that he wouldn't slip on the floor, which seems like, in retrospect, such an easy, obvious thing, but you're not in that mindset and don't really know where to look or who to ask, or don't have somebody just offering you, you know, a book full of suggestions for things to look out for. But I did find some good resources. There was an organization that I've ended up remaining quite involved with called the International Association for Animal Hospice and Palliative Care. And it's just a group of veterinarians and other animal care professionals trying to make the end-of-life experience better for animals and people. So that's a really valuable resource found at the time. And
do you think it's better for an animal to be in a hospice, or to go quickly? I guess that's a situational kind of question.
It's very situational, and I think it's, yeah, really hard to answer. I mean, one thing to say is that hospice is really, it's different for animals in that there isn't a place. It's not a place, it's a mindset. And I think the mindset is that, okay, our number one priority with this animal is to make his or her remaining time as good as we possibly can, as comfortable as we possibly can. And sometimes you can keep an animal really comfortable and happy through an extended illness or disability, and sometimes you can't.
Right.
And the kindest thing to do is then to hasten the dying process or shorten the dying process. So it's really hard to generalize.
Yeah, it's really a very
trying time when you have an older companion animal that's been with you for 20 years and you see them start to decline. And, you know, if you take them to the vet and they try to do all this life-saving surgeries and procedures.
CAT scans.
Or like getting all their teeth pulled or something
that.
And you're just like, it's very hard to know what the right thing to do is because you don't want them to be in pain from a rotten tooth, but you don't want them to die of an infection from getting a tooth pulled either. So it's very difficult. And
it's extremely difficult. And people are always asking for advice and how do I do this? And it's so hard to give because, as you suggest, it's so case by case dependent. But I think just having the sort of emphasis on good quality of life in mind and how can we, for this particular animal, each animal is different. I have my dog Maya is now 14, so I'm dealing with this again. She hates the vet. It's really, really, really stressful. So that figures into our treatment decisions. And we're more likely to say no to things because it's just so awful for her. But, I know people who have dogs who love going to the vet. I mean, that's how weird, but they do. So it really depends on the animal. And
Strangely enough, my dog Titan, who we just lost a couple months ago, when he'd go to the vet's office, he'd actually take a nap there. I was like, what kind of dog actually is so comfortable that he just lays down and takes a nap? But, we did struggle. And I think part of the struggle, too, is, you go and you're in this moment and they say, okay, well, we can try this, as Liz said, we can try this $2,000 surgery. And you don't know if it's going to work or help. But I think, with losing some, at least, you have some options. But I know in the past with some of our other companion animals, we've gone to the vet and they haven't offered the holistic approach. They say, okay, well, it's just the dog getting old. Well, there isn't a conversation about, like you said, trying to provide comfort and, like with humans, looking at our diet, what can we be changing in their diet to actually make them happier and healthier and other ways to try and treat their problems.
Or even the pain management, because I remember not even that long ago, since I moved to El Paso, our vet did a procedure on one of our animals and I'm like, well, are you going to, give me some pain medicine? And she was like, no, we don't. They don't need it. And I'm like, if I just had this done, I sure as think you would need one. So I requested it and got some. But now when I take my animals to the same exact vet, she's all about, preventing the pain. And I think there's been a lot of evolution even among vets in realizing that these animals do suffer pain after these procedures. And, you can provide some comfort through some medications. I don't want to say that I want all my animals doped up, but after they've had like half their teeth pulled, they didn't.
Yeah.
They need something for pain as well as antibiotics and all of that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, though. Things have evolved quite a bit. And, there are resources for pet owners, too, or animal companion owners. I don't really like the word pet so much. That can facilitate being an advocate for your animal when you go to the vet and say, this pain med's not working. Let's try something else. And really just not stopping with, what happened with Odie, and I just didn't know any better, is, I'm like, well, he looks like he's in pain, having this conversation with my vet and my vet saying, well, okay, we'll try tramadol. Tramadol didn't work, didn't do anything. And so that was the end of the conversation. And now, if I told that story to one of my hospice veterinary friends, they would just say, oh, my God, no. because there's so many other things that we can try. And, one of the things that I really don't like to hear veterinarians say is, well, we can either do X, all the expensive, complicated treatments you were suggesting, or we can do nothing. Because that puts so much pressure on the pet owner. Because if you decline those treatments, it's not that you're doing nothing. You're choosing instead to offer comfort care. So just changing the language, the way we talk about those end-of-life choices, can make a huge difference for how guardians or whatever language you want to use. I know we're technically owners, but that feels awkward, I know, to those of us who have animals as part of our family. But just changing the language that we use, that veterinarians use to talk about, and the way we think about it, it's not a binary choice of you know, complicated treatment or nothing.
And sometimes you do go through a procedure and spend $2,000 and the animal lives another 5 wonderful years. So,
right.
I mean, that's what makes it so scary because you're like, oh, my God, you know.
And yeah, you want to have peace knowing that you tried everything that you could.
Yeah.
And that's,
right.
you know, that's.
Yes, we need those crystal balls.
I lost my cat companion of 17 years in February. And fortunately for me, it was quick. It came in. It happened overnight. He collapsed and couldn't stand or walk. Cancer had gone to his brain. So the decision was rather easy for me. But I found myself crying much harder than I did at the death of either of my parents. And I sort of wondered about that. Was it because I was with my cat every day and I only saw my parents, you know, for a week once a year or so? Or is there something more to it that we grieve for our pets so hard?
You know, I've heard that from a number of people, that same response. And I think you hit the nail on the head. We spend so much time with our animals and they're so integrated into our lives and into who we are. More so even than our children in some ways, because our children grow up and go off and become independent. You know, one thing that I would love to see in our culture, in our society, is more compassion toward people who have lost a companion animal, because often you get this, well, it's just a dog.
Oh, yeah.
Get over it. Move on. Get another one.
I can't imagine anybody saying that.
I know.
Well, I can. I've had people say it to me.
Yeah.
Even my
people
own vet that I
hear
love.
That.
Yeah.
You know, and if you call in and say you can't go to work because you've had a death in the family, don't tell them that it's been an animal member of the family, because you won't get the day off.
No, I got the day off.
That's nice. Well, you have compassionate coworkers.
And I think that's the challenge, too, is like even for humans in the medical care, you know, you'd find doctors who are really so much more empathetic and, you know, are understanding the grieving process. And it's the same with the veterinary profession. There's really many great vets. And but I think people have a perception that all vets are, you know, the really super sweet and kind people. And some are definitely more on the scientific side, I think, and they're less compassionate and more mindful of the emotional all the emotional issues that go with your companion animal.
I was appreciative when I got a sympathy card from the staff of the vet clinic after
I had
Parker.
We got that too. Our vet even made a donation to a hospice-related organization for companion animals after Titan passed. So it was really, it just showed a lot about her, you know, her character and the kind of person that she and professional that she is.
Yeah, and it's a good reminder to your listeners that, you know, if you don't feel comfortable with your vet or don't feel like it's quite the right match for you or for your animals, go look around, do some shopping.
One question you raised in one of your blogs was if animals have an awareness of their own impending death. What do you think about that?
I think I really don't know. That's my answer. I feel like, you know, when people say, and you read this in even the scientific literature, oh, we know for sure animals don't have a concept of death. They don't have any awareness. I think that's overstating things.
Oh, yeah.
There's just no research on it to speak. I mean, not very much. And actually, there's an emerging body of research into technically what they call, those doing it call, you know, like animal thanatology or death studies. And it's fascinating. And I think the answer is animals know a lot more than we think they know.
Oh, yeah.
And are aware of a lot more than we think they are. And we need to keep an open mind about it.
And I wonder to some degree, too, like I think about, you know, our other dogs that we have after Titan passed, you know, especially my dog Ray was really close with Titan. And when he doesn't come back home, and it, you know, when he passed at the vet's office and he doesn't come back home, I just wonder about how if there's better closure for the animal, if they have some sort of better idea of what happened or what happened. Because now, you know, she'd be walking around the house, you know, looking at the other empty dog bed. And, you know, she just, you could tell that it definitely affected her. And I wonder about whether having some closure or if there is a way to you know, try and transmit that message in some simple way.
Yeah, one possible thing to do that I've written about is you can have a wake for an animal just like you can for a person, and you could take the body with you from the vet's office, take the body home, you know, give the other animals a chance to see and smell and say goodbye or whatever it is that they need to do, and then take the body either back to the vet to have the vet take care of cremation or whatever it is that you've chosen to do, or do that yourself.
Well, in our remaining minute, could you just tell us a little bit about your new book with Mark Beckoff, The Animal's Agenda? Because it sounds
sure.
fascinating.
Yeah. I guess the main motivation for writing that book was a feeling that Mark and I both have had kind of growing over the years, that this sense of frustration that the science of animal cognition, I mean, everything we're learning about just how smart animals are and how emotional and how much is going on inside of animals, just it's really not translating into meaningful changes yeah. in how humans interact with animals. And so the question that motivated the book was, why isn't science helping animals more than it is? And the one of the main conclusions we came to is that the sort of funneling of science into animal welfare is actually harming animals in a lot of ways, because we make these kind of tweaks to the system that might help animals a little bit, but it doesn't change the system itself, and the system itself is really exploitive and cruel. So, and then it makes people feel better about things, so yeah. so less gets done to help animals. So that's the, in a nutshell.
Well, Jessica, we've, like I said, we barely scratched the surface on some of your other books, but can you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about your various work?
Sure. I have a website, just my name, jessicapierce.net, and there's my Psychology Today blog that you mentioned, and the books are easy to find on Amazon, just searching my name, most of them are University of Chicago Press, although The Animal's Agenda, the most recent one, is Beacon Press, so on the publisher's websites. And my email address is on my website, so anybody who wants to get in touch and continue the conversation, feel free.
We've been talking with author and bioethicist Jessica Pierce. Thanks a lot for being with us, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Keep up
Jessica.
The good work.
It's fascinating to learn how our companion animals may suffer at the end of death, but we should also remember all of the factory farm animals and all of the other farm animals that suffer every day just for our dietary choices. If you'd like to learn more about a vegetarian or a vegan diet, you can go to the Vegetarian Society of El Paso website, vsep.org.
And on August the 26th, the Vegetarian Society of El Paso will be showing the movie What the Health, a documentary which exposes why major medical organizations don't want to talk about a plant-based diet. To find out information about this movie and a vegan buffet at the Radisson El Paso Airport, please go to vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACK Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button. Until next time, I'm Tom Lenny.
I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.